Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Few of our wetter spots, generally stretching from the Ohio Valley southward to the Gulf Coast. We have five states in that area reporting double-digit topsoil moisture surpluses.
Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA taking a look at topsoil moisture conditions.
Top of the list is Louisiana at 25% surplus. Other states meeting that double-digit threshold, all coming in this week at 11% surplus. Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, and Ohio. As we move to the flip side, the more dominant dryness, especially across the western and central United States, we continue to see that string of six states from Montana to Texas, even with recent rainfall, reporting topsoil moisture very short-to-short ratings greater than 70%.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As we go through, the next few months, USDA NAS does have access to these certified acreage numbers as they come out. And as we know, the certified acreage report was actually delayed by about 10 days just because of the backlog, I guess, within USDA on some other programs that they've been developing and delivering. So there was a little bit of a delay on the certified acreage being released.
Sean Wade with Plains Cotton Growers.
So that may have impacted the NAS information just a little bit. From a Texas perspective, comparing the two, the FSA numbers as far as planted acres on upland cotton, appear to be higher than what NAS has on the books right now. So that, that planted acres number for NAS may well go up. But as we look at, within this, just everything that's going on, we know that there are more acres to be reported as failed in the state as well. And so, the question is going to be, as those acres get reported into FSA and everything starts to, kind of be balanced out, and compared one to the other, what adjustments will NAS make over the next few months, if any, to kind of bring those acreage numbers in line. There's certainly not a lot to point to that would say that NAS is really far off the mark as far as their crop goes, unless, like I said, maybe they're underestimating some of those acreages just a little bit, which, may have pushed, a 12.6 million bale forecast for the U.S. Maybe there's some acres out there that when they get it all put back together, maybe we do, crawl back up to a 13.2. Million bale crop. I don't really know, what that's going to look like. But we do know that we don't have all of the failed acres accounted for on the high plains of Texas, much less in the rest of Texas. And over the next month or so, federal crop interest will be switching from from stand count to, bowl count appraisal mustard. So, we'll likely see some of this cotton that, it's to a stand. But it's just kind of been existing for the last few months. Once they can do bulk counts on it, they'll actually go in and try to do a yield estimate on what's out in the field. And we may see, like I said, we would expect to see maybe some more acres get failed out as well. So, can't say with much certainty that, USDA NAS's crop report is off the mark by very much. But it may certainly see some adjustment, as we go over the next few months.
Dan O'Brien's a grain economist at Kansas State.
Glenn Tonzer, our friend and colleague, could talk quite a bit about the impact we've already had on cow herd and what that will bring about, what's almost forcing to happen in coming months in terms of livestock numbers for placement in feedlots, what in terms of meat markets, what type of impact that will have on feed demand, probably be lower in some of these areas. So we've got some real dynamic and challenging, i.e. troubling things happening. I hear a good discussion, no doubt you too, in talking with people about just the availability of hay in some of these areas, just really sought after and tough market. So I think for us, we've been so affected by this Western Corn Belt event, again, the ongoing La Nina weather pattern that we've had. We have had some discussion from a climatologist who've indicated that we could be in line for a third year of La Nina. And it's not unprecedented, but as you start to string these together, you're starting to look more like the 1930s than a regular in and out pattern.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I want to just talk a little bit about our process.
Former Senator from North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp, testifying earlier this year at a House Ag Committee hearing on climate change.
We started out, Saxby and I did, by saying, boy, have things changed. You know, when we were in the Senate, if you had talked about climate and farmers and rural America in the same sentence, you might have been drummed out of the room. The attitudes of rural America and farmers have really changed as they have seen the consequences of climate, but also as they see the opportunity of growing to a global market, growing for and selling to a global market and what that means. And so we were very convinced that the time was right for us to begin this process. I want to just report what a soybean farmer said to me in North Dakota when I asked him about climate. He said, I expect that we are going to have to be able to prove sustainability and climate sensitivity for the commodities that we sell into the global market in the future. Let's get going. The next step that we took was evaluate where we are. And I really have to give a shout out to the great staff at BPC. They did a great job in evaluating what that looks like. Second, I want to reiterate kind of the goals. Do no harm. Let's keep the programs that are working for us. Make it economically important and viable to adapt some of these challenges. And let's make sure that we don't leave behind something that hasn't been said here. The early adapters. I'm always sensitive to people who, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. You know, where's my benefit? You're trying to promote change in other producers. Do I get a benefit from change? And so we basically came up with a list of, when you look at it, six themes. And I want to focus on two because I don't have a lot of time left. The first one is workforce. You have all the data in the world, but if you don't have somebody ready to engage with farmers and ranchers on the ground, in the field, telling them, you know, look what your neighbor did over here. How are we going to kind of help you understand how these programs work? And so, you know, you can design all these programs, you can have all the pilot programs in the world, but if you don't have an implementation strategy for those programs, this won't work. And so that's why it's so important that we educate that next generation of farmers. The second thing I want to highlight is carbon markets. And I know that hasn't always been a subject of consensus on your committee, but I want to just relay some of the things that we heard. People who are going to buy into carbon markets, they want certainty. They want to know that they're not buying something that just simply they're buying something that actually has a climate impact. They have reputational risk if they don't. And as they talk about their own carbon sensitivity, they want to make sure that they're getting the bang for the buck and the environment's getting the bang for the buck. And so that's why a lot of the research and a lot of the work that's being done by the committee to kind of evaluate how do we give it the good housekeeping seal of approval, if I can use those words. And I know that Secretary of Agriculture is very engaged, and certainly the Growing Climate Solutions Act would task the secretary with that. I think it's important that that work start as soon as possible, because that's where we're going to see a huge benefit, economic benefit for our ag producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
And I want to express my frustration at the fact that I don't believe we're focusing enough on the numerous challenges that rural Americans are currently facing as a result of high inflation.
Senate hearing last spring on the rural quality of life. Senator John Thune from South Dakota.
You got rising food and energy costs. There's a lot of global commodity market uncertainty and volatility. And I think those are the types of things that I would like to see the committee, Madam Chair, focus on. And I, again, would urge the committee to follow through on a request that Senators Marshall, Ernst, and I have made to hold a hearing on the current agricultural supply chain challenges and ideas for improving the situation for our producers. We all hear it. Input costs, doesn't matter what it is, diesel fuel, fertilizer, equipment, everything is going through the roof, and I think we're going to really see the results of that in the ag economy in this next season as they start planting crops and harvesting those crops. So I hope we can have a hearing on that subject.
Also at that same Senate Ag Committee hearing, the chairwoman of the committee from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow.
There is no question that costs are up. Good news is prices are up. Economy is strong. Bad news is input costs are up. And so I'm very pleased that as a result of funding that we put in the American Rescue Plan, that the Biden administration is moving forward now as it relates to fertilizer inputs. We need to be making those in America and not relying on other countries. Same thing with the supply chains. We need to have more resiliency in our supply chains. That's why the money we put in the American Rescue Plan to help support small and medium-sized meat processing operations to create competition, to make sure we're not relying on the big four companies. They're primarily international. It's really important. So there's no question on supply chains. And again, coming out of a global pandemic, we hope we're coming out of this and with supply chains broken down, the economy shut down in America as well as all over the world. I'm not surprised that our generation, which is facing something we've not faced in our generation, is now having to figure out how we put all these pieces back together and match them up. And so we've got a lot of challenges and prices are going up and we've got to continue to do everything we can to support our growers and our families to bring those down, which brings us back to today because that also relates to the things that directly relate to families who want to live in rural Michigan, who want to live in rural America. And certainly it's what's happening on inputs on the farm. It's also what's happening for families. It's also childcare. It's also care for our moms and dads and grandpas and grandmas. It's also not driving three counties away for mental health help or health help and all the other things that we need so that folks will want to live, so that the next generation of farmers, young people, farmers will want to come and stay. I want them to stay in rural Michigan. And that's what this is all about. So we've heard from our witnesses today that the care economy is important and needs to be supported as part of the whole picture, whether that's child care, elder care, or health care, mental health, physical, behavioral health. Our rural families' ability to access quality of life care is important. It's key to economic prosperity for all of us. There's a lot of great work that's being done. We appreciate what you are doing. I look forward to continuing our strong relationship with the USDA and rural communities across our country as we work to improve access to quality care services at all stages of life.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The U.S. average retail price for on-highway diesel fuel remained at $4.91 a gallon on Monday, based on the weekly price survey by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Diesel prices were highest in the West Coast states, at $5.55 a gallon, up 7 cents from a week ago. Prices were lowest in the Gulf Coast region at $4.62 a gallon, up 5 cents.
Meg Freeburn is with the U.S. EIA, Energy Information Administration.
The U.S. average retail price for regular gasoline fell to $3.88 a gallon on Monday. That's down 5.8 cents from a week ago, based on the weekly price survey by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Pump prices were highest in the West Coast states, at $4.85 a gallon, down 6.5 cents from a week ago. Prices were lowest in the Gulf Coast region at $3.40 a gallon, down 2.5 cents.
So let's move from one source of energy to another now. Dr. Darrell Peel is with Oklahoma State University. He talks about tight hay supplies, energy for livestock.
Hay production in Oklahoma is estimated to be down about 10% on a year-over-year basis. And, you know, on May 1, our hay stocks estimate was down almost 48%. So when you combine those two together, the hay supply for this year, the beginning stocks plus hay production, is down about 17%. And that's true in most of the major, several of the major hay states, which are also big beef cattle states. A combination of either reduced May 1 supplies, which is really carryover impacts from drought earlier, plus reduced production this year, is leading to very tight hay supplies in all of this region and generally across the country.
So with tighter supplies, higher prices?
Hay prices are already high again. We've had carryover impact from last year, but we're going to set record prices for alfalfa hay and for all other hay without a doubt.
And obviously, pasture conditions have been suffering.
We've seen drought re-advance again this midsummer. In Oklahoma, about two-thirds of our pasture is currently rated at poor to very poor. Just 9% is rated in good condition, and 0% is rated in excellent condition. So, you know, again, we're nearly through the growing season. It's going to be a long winter with a combination of not much hay and not much forage to work with.
And this all spells one thing. A reduction in cattle herds.
We've already seen a lot of movement so far this year, but if you look in the last 4 weeks in Oklahoma, auction volumes for feeder cattle are up about 11%. Well, that would suggest that we're probably weaning calves early, moving cattle, those feeder cattle into town early. And then on the cull cow side, you know, again, we've seen really strong cow slaughter this year. The auction volume for cull cows in the last 4 weeks is up 115%, so more than double for the same period a year ago.
One thing we can find surprising about all this news, cattle markets remain strong.
You know, there is good news actually in prices in the cattle markets. Despite all of these impacts, despite the increased volume of cattle moving through the markets, prices are actually very strong. So we're seeing prices for feeder cattle advancing, and we predicted that generally. There's a trend of stronger cattle prices. Cattle numbers are getting tighter over time. And so despite these drought impacts, we're seeing stronger feeder cattle prices, and even the cull cow market with the volume we had. There was a couple of weeks in July when the volume really overwhelmed the market, and we saw prices drop briefly. But they've bounced right back and continue to be very, very strong at this point.
So at the end of the line, it's slaughter numbers. And USDA out with their latest slaughter report for July and a 3% year-over-year decrease across the U.S. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Extreme climate events are changing California's ecosystems.
Dr. Glenda Humiston with the University of California's Ag and Natural Resources.
Fires, floods, drought, and more invasive pests are already affecting agriculture. For example, unseasonably warm weather now causes many fruit and nut trees to bloom before the last frost, causing great economic losses. Changing climate decreases water supplies, increases wildfires, and threatens agricultural productivity. To combat this, we must enable working landscapes to adapt and become a solution to climate change. According to the National Academy of Sciences, U.S. soils and forests have the potential to sequester about 500 million metric tons of carbon dioxide annually. Markets for carbon credits are one solution to move us there. Such climate smart practices require we fully utilize USDA programs and leverage collaborations between government, academia, and the private sector. We need voluntary market and incentive-based programs and a focus on science-based outcomes. New science and technologies will allow farmers to remain economically viable while generating co-benefits such as improved water-holding capacity of soils, pollinator habitat, and carbon sequestration. We're moving to expand relations between the life sciences and engineering and other technology specialists to develop those complex solutions to these challenges. Some examples are placing solar panels over irrigation canals to reduce evaporation of precious irrigation water while also producing electricity, something Congressman Costa has long supported. Implementing healthy soil practices to improve groundwater recharge and dairy digesters to create biofuels rather than harmful greenhouse gases. Other opportunities exist in forest health efforts that convert excessive fuel loads, biomass, into valuable bioproducts. Expanding the capacity to manufacture advanced wood products can support economic development in rural communities. Examples of this work include converting that biomass into hydrogen and liquid biofuels to replace diesel and trucks. In California, we're excited to work with the governor and the state legislature to secure a $185 million investment in UC to expand climate-focused research, innovation, and workforce development. This funding will establish regional workforce hubs to provide on-the-job training opportunities for students and leverage career certification programs for college prep and non-degree-seeking individuals.
Testifying recently at a House Ag Committee hearing on the role of climate change, Kristen Weeks Duncanson is a Minnesota family farmer.
My husband Pat and I own Highland Family Farms in Mapleton, Minnesota. We grow soybeans, corn, small grains, and raise hogs. We practice conservation on our acres. We are transitioning some acres to organic production and are even considering how we can grow saplings on some marginal lands to help supply reforestation efforts in the northern part of our state. I'm also a member of the Agree Coalition, a group that builds consensus around ideas that will make agriculture more resilient, profitable, and sustainable. As a business owner and farmer, better information is the foundation of how I manage risk from disruptions to our operation due to pandemics, wars, or climate change. This committee has repeatedly asked, how do we convince farmers to adopt conservation practices? The answer is simple. It's better data. Data that is up to date, accessible, and can be analyzed to show the costs and benefits of conservation practices. USDA and private sector companies both collect data, an enormous amount of it, from farmers. USDA has the opportunity to use our data to advance widespread adoption of conservation.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Let me just ask, Dr. Holtz-Eakin, we've seen inflation hitting all aspects of the economy. Food prices are up, gas prices are up. What is inflation's effect on the healthcare system? And does it result in more cost shifting for workers who have insurance through their jobs? And maybe you can touch on how that affects Medicare and Medicaid.
South Dakota Senator John Thune at a Senate Ag Committee hearing back in the spring on the rural quality of life. He's questioning Dr. Douglas Holtz-Eakin, president of the American Action Foundation.
All good questions, Senator. The healthcare system is going to face rising input costs like everyone else. We've got transportation costs for the supplies. We've got wage costs for the employees. Facilities costs, shelter is now a central part of the inflation problem. That's going to spread to commercial real estate. And so broadly, input costs are going to rise. People are going to face budget deficits in their planning. Certainly, that's something that I worry about in my business. And you have to find a way to accommodate that. And so will it be cutting off care or will it be raising the cost of that care? Neither is a particularly attractive option. And the healthcare sector is going to face a lot of that over the next year. For workers, they are getting wage increases, but those wage increases are not enough to keep up with inflation. And if their health insurance goes up, the typical response of employers is to minimize the amount of wage increases they give to sort of cover the benefit bill, and you just don't get a cash increase. That exacerbates the problem they face. And so that's a cost shifting on the workers that will be prevalent over the next two or three years. I think that will be quite clear.
So, as you know, I come from a rural state, and naturally I'm very concerned about the closure of hospitals and nursing homes in rural America, which is why I find the Biden administration's position on nursing home mandates and staffing to be so perplexing. As it is, nursing homes are competing with fast food restaurants and in bigger cities, Amazon warehouses to find workers. And let me be clear, we all want nursing homes to be safe and our loved ones to have quality care. But the president just proposed new requirements on staffing and potential enforcement penalties that make me wonder if anyone is thinking about how rural nursing homes are going to be able to make it. USDA's rural development initiatives can be helpful here, but they can't be a substitute for other policies that fail to consider the needs of rural America. So could you tell me your perspective on how federal mandates are going to affect access to care in rural America?
I certainly think this is a concern in the specific in rural America. These mandates on the nursing homes to have fewer multi-patient rooms, more single rooms, higher staffing requirements. These are all costs of doing business, and they are going to be mandated cost increases that are not obviously easy to cover given the business model. So again, unpleasant choices will be present. Do we raise the prices? Do we closed different branches to make things go, that's inevitable. And this isn't a general problem with the regulatory state, which is that we have programs that fund things, but with the other hand, we're raising the cost of doing those very activities. And the Biden administration finalized $200 billion worth of regulatory costs in its first year in office That's the largest number of any administration since we started tracking this. And it is raising the cost of business at a time when inflation is already pressing people and making things difficult.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says that with an aging food and agricultural workforce, with less than 8% of the USDA's workforce, for example, being under the age of 35,
it's really necessary and important for us in the food and agriculture industry to continue to look for ways in which we can recruit, train, educate, and attract the next generation of leaders,
especially young scholars from minority-serving schools and colleges. And so Vilsack has just announced an investment, $250 million, for what he calls the Next Gen Ag Leaders Program, in which minority-serving institutions will apply for grant money.
And those resources can go to the development of scholarships, the funding of internships and fellowships,
to expand opportunities for students so they can find out for themselves what Tom Vilsack's been saying for a long time.
The food and agriculture industry is indeed one of the most innovative and exciting places to be now and in the future.
Vilsack said he's hoping this program will help inspire students to be part of the industry and will, in turn,
build that next generation of leaders.
Gary Crawford, Washington.